Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 4th, 2011. There is stiff competition for jobs out there, so how do you stand out against all the other candidates?
If someone has enough initiative to drive and hand-deliver a resume to every single veterinarian in the Willamette Valley, this person must really want a job.
Secrets of successful job applicants. And curious about your credit score? Well, it might reflect what's happening in your city.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing higher credit scores here in the Wausau area, and I just think it's that people are more conservative with their money. There's not a lot of flashy things to do around here.
Plus, a new program provides credit for small businesses, courtesy of a donation you could make with your Grande Half-Calf Latte.
There's millions of people who come through Starbucks every day, and I believe we've created the kind of proposition that they will trust and support.
A conversation with Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
On the first Friday of each month, you can almost hear people crossing their fingers as the government releases the latest job figures. Well, this week we learned that the unemployment rate dropped ever so slightly to an even 9%, and companies added a net 80,000 jobs to their payrolls. The overall picture, though, is still, in a word, awful. Nearly half of the unemployed have been looking for 6 months or longer. For every available job right now, there are more than four people fighting for it. But someone is getting it, right? So what accounts for the winners? We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to figure out what is behind a job hunt success.
Yes, you can.
It's a hallmark moment at Willamette Valley Animal Hospital in Salem, Oregon. Two little girls, their mom, and the frightened Chihuahua puppy they just got from the pound are visiting the vet for the first time. And here's the young animal doc, just out of vet school, Megan Weekly.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Dr. Weekly.
So this is Lucky.
How long have you had Lucky? It's
2 days.
How are we adjusting so far?
I'm a little shy.
For Weekly, treating family pets in a suburban strip mall is more than a hallmark moment. It's a godsend. After graduating with a diploma from Oregon State University and $130,000 in student loan debt, the young vet looked for work for well over a year without success.
So for a while, I mainly looked within reasonable driving distance, and then as months went by, I expanded to all of the state, and every place I'd go, you know, there were so many other experienced people looking for jobs, so.
Did you despair at any point?
I did. I mean, my husband has a good job and was able to support me. Towards the end, I was going around the state, handing out resumes, you know, walking in clinics. And that's how I ended up getting this job, was walking in.
She was lucky. She landed a job close to home. John Madigan's the man who hired her.
If someone has enough initiative to drive and hand deliver a resume to every single veterinarian in the Willamette Valley, this person must really want a job.
Madigan's vet clinic has expanded right through the recession, but at the time Megan Weekly walked through the door, he didn't have a job to offer. Still,
what I can't teach is attitude, and she had a phenomenal attitude. And I think all employers, whether it's for me or small business or large business, we look to buy attitude.
And so he did, bringing her on full time. And here's the thing, with so few jobs being created and so many people competing for them, you have to offer a potential employer something unique so they'll pick you out of the crowd.
The woman you're describing was very lucky. She just happened to hit it at the right time with the right person. I think it's the needle in the haystack approach.
Career coach Ford Myers is author of the book Get the Job You Want Even When No One's Hiring, and he insists success is much more likely to come from an entrepreneurial mindset. First, identifying and targeting a few carefully chosen professional connections and then working them, whether face-to-face or via social media sites like LinkedIn.
Stop presenting yourself as a candidate, stop acting like an applicant, and instead, start acting like a solution provider. Start acting more like a consultant, a problem solver.
Outplacement expert John Challenger agrees that rising above a crowded field often requires this same entrepreneurial approach. And since many employers have doubts about hiring the long-term unemployed, he says selling yourself may mean lowering your price.
Sometimes it may come down to a negotiation where you might say to that employer, I'm open to taking something less, but let me prove it to you. And if you like the work I've done, would you consider paying me at the level that I was making before?
And Challenger says if you have been out of work for a while, make sure you've got something to show for it.
It makes sense to take volunteer work, project or part-time work. Say you took time off to take care of an aging parent. Explain that not only in the resume and put that in, but in the interview.
Megan Weekly, the young vet, did all that, volunteering, working at the Humane Society. She says it kept her skills current and her spirits up, but she's pretty sure what landed her a job in the end wasn't listing all that stuff on the resumes that she hand-delivered up and down the state. It was just the fact that she showed up. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
So when we talk about successfully landing that job, modern technology is one of today's best tools, from social networking to internet career sites. But one tool that is decidedly analog is widely considered the granddaddy of them all, a book called What Color Is Your Parachute? Richard Bowles wrote it 40 years ago, and it's now a job hunting Bible. Mr. Bowles joins us to mark this big anniversary. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with a question you've probably heard every year for the past 40 years. What is so different about the job market now than the last time you updated the book?
Well, for one thing, people have much more lost hope this time out. You go to job clubs where you used to see dozens and dozens of people that were gathered once a week. And now oftentimes you go back to those same places and you discover there's just a skeleton crew left and you wonder, does this mean they all found jobs? And you inquire and they say, no. They just gave up.
Well, you say pretty early on in your book that it's not a job hunting book, that it is a book about life in big letters, work, small letters, designing. So life, work, designing. What does that mean?
It means that when you try to figure out what kind of work you're going to be able to find, there are two routes you can possibly go. The first route is you can settle for whatever is available. You can ask, what are the hot jobs? That's one route. The other route is you can say, I'm not likely to find exactly what it is I'm looking for, but there should be a great overlap between my vision and the reality. And therefore, I'm going to start with a large vision of what it is I'm trying to find as my life's work. And this involves sitting down and figuring out what you want your life to count for, what you want to be able to say you were able to do when you come near the end of your life. It's not just a matter of figuring out what are the best job hunting methods or that sort of thing. It's a matter of sitting down and doing some hard thinking about who you are, what it is you have to offer to the world, and what kinds of passions you bring to the world.
Your book at a higher level is about much more than making yourself able to be hired. It's about, you know, as you say, what color is your parachute? What is your life's calling? And I think over the last 3 years, a lot of people who have been thrown out of work have tried to ask themselves that question. Am I in the right line of work? Is there something else that I would rather do? But at the same time, they're also fighting pretty steep emotional curves, just dealing with the fact of unemployment. What's your advice there?
Well, the first thing is nobody should be job hunting by themselves. If at all possible, they should be linked to some other person who is in a similar situation, or they should be in a job support group. There's a lovely list of those at a job site called job-hunt.org.
And we'll have a link to that on our website.
Yeah, you can help get yourself through the almost inevitable kind of depression, whether it's a big depression or whether it's a I'm feeling really blue this morning kind of depression. By yourself, you brood, you obsess, you get worried about not sleeping well, and all kinds of mischief creeps in.
Are times like these a time to reconsider what your passion is and what the color of your parachute is? Or is this a time where you're going to be lucky to kind of get a job, period?
Unfortunately, there's no one answer to that question, and it's a very good question, of course. The problem is this. when people sit down in this kind of a time, they have that choice. Do I just settle for what it is I can find out there by doing the simplest kind of a job search? Or do I sit down and try to get a vision clear in my head and in great detail of what it is I really want to do with my life? Because if I have that kind of a vision, it will give me the energy to persist and keep at this, even if in the end I only find something that overlaps it to some degree. As a first step after you get out of unemployment, you have to be realistic. I may not find exactly what I'm looking for, but I will find a piece of it. So you need to start with a large enough vision to begin with that a piece of it means something that you really still are quite excited about, and that will give you the energy to persist with the job hunt no matter how long it lasts.
Richard Bowles is the author of the book, What Color is Your Parachute? It is now in its 40th edition. He's joined us from San Francisco. Thank you so much, sir.
You're very welcome.
And stay tuned for more jobs coverage later in the show when we talk with Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz about his new microfinance program for small businesses.
A few weeks ago, I went to my college reunion. Okay, it was my 35th. I still can't believe it's been that long.
Marketplace economics editor Chris Farrell.
My classmates had a little less hair, a bit more weight, and some more wrinkles. For some, life had taken a turn for the worse. But for many, things turned out better than expected. On the flight home, I thought about the conversations I had during the reunion. I ended up thinking about what I learned about personal finance. The first thing is, no one talked about the size of their house or the clothes in their closet. I didn't stand next to anyone murmuring deep regret over not having bought a fancy car. What did we talk about? Partners, children, friends, adventures. In other words, we talked about what we truly value in life, memorable experiences, times that shaped our character. Of course, we all know this is true, yet it's easy to forget in the rush of modern life. The second lesson involves regret. The only thing my classmates regretted was a risk not taken. When I got home, I looked up a wonderful passage by Henry David Thoreau in Walden Pond. He disdains the man who dreams of becoming a poet, but first must make his fortune. Poetry, the guy thought, could wait for retirement. Thoreau's advice? What are you waiting for? My last takeaway from the reunion was that it's hard to find the right balance between saving for the future and pursuing your passions. Sure, personal finance starts with learning what you want out of life. But the discovery changes as we age. We also make mistakes, and life tosses us a curve, say, a layoff or a sick parent. There's never enough money. So what? This is the right way to think about money. Personal finance should follow the dreams, not the other way around.
Chris Farrell, send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is the time in the show where we take your questions. With us this week is Kathy Kristoff, personal finance columnist for Kiplinger's Magazine. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to quickly talk to you, because we have talked about this before on the program, about something that happened this week, which is that Bank of America backed down on the debit card fees.
Yep.
Two questions. First of all, does this mean actually that the consumer has some power? But second of all, aren't they just going to find some other way to make that money?
Well, that's what you have to watch. And because, yes, I think the big banks are forever tempted to find some other sneaky way to make money off of you. But consumers have a lot of power. And I think it wasn't just B of A that backed off on debit card fees.
They all did.
Yeah, everybody said, oh, we were testing it, but decided
never
it was
mind.
A bad idea. Right, exactly. We're going to go away now. And it was because there was a huge movement to move your accounts from big banks to credit unions and community banks.
Yeah, in fact, this weekend is Move Your Bank Day.
Yeah, Bank Transfer Day.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
In fact, we talked with the founder of that a couple of weeks ago on the show, and folks can find that on our website.
Yeah, it's quite phenomenal. And you know what the thing is? We're in a different world because, you know, B of A got its size because they were on every corner. And
yep.
In the days when you got a physical check and you needed to go in on Friday and deposit it, that was really convenient. you don't really need your big bank. I think consumers are realizing that, and I think the big banks might be realizing that.
But, you know, as we mentioned up top, this does mean that they're, I mean, they're going to want to make that money back somehow. One of the pluses, if you can call it that, of the debit card fee was that it was transparent. What do we look for in terms of now perhaps some hidden fees that'll land on our doorstep or in our checking accounts?
Well, this is an era that you absolutely, positively must read your mail.
Yeah.
Banks are disclosing stuff in little statement stuffers that we have all expected to be just junk mail
right. And
throw away. Don't throw them away. And also handle your banking transactions very carefully. Make sure you know what the minimum balance requirements are of your account. That's probably the biggest thing. And if you suddenly have to pay for checking when it's been free because you had the minimum balance, because you didn't pay attention to that, that's going to be a lot more expensive than the debit card fee. Otherwise, I think there's always the possibility that bankers will decide to make money the old-fashioned way and actually loan out money at interest. It could happen,
yeah.
And that might be good for everyone.
Okay. Well, let's hit the phones, and Tim is with us from Eugene, Oregon. Quack, quack.
Quack, quack.
I'm an Oregonian as well, so I know that the Ducks are the big team in Eugene, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes, indeed.
How are they doing this year?
Really good, with the exception of that opening loss to LSU. It's been a great year.
Yeah. So, as we mentioned, this weekend is Bank Transfer Day. Are you happy with your bank?
Yeah, actually, I've been a member of a credit union for going on 8 years now. I left the big banks behind and haven't looked back. Heck, they pay interest on my checking account.
What?
Yeah.
You know, when was the last time you heard like a Bank of America customer say, you know, praise their bank?
I love B of A.
Oh, they're so great. They're just really good to me.
All right. So what can we help you out with today?
So I've had an interesting sort of set of problems, I guess, is the best way to explain it. About 5 years ago, I got involved with my partner. Things have been going really well. We're a blended family, right? So it's her and myself and her two children. I'd never really planned on saving for kids for college. I'd always been just looking at my retirement.
So how old are the kids?
16 and 13.
Okay, so teenagers.
Yeah, and we've been kind of an interesting spot so much that between the two of us, we have no debt other than our mortgage, which is actually pretty good. But other than that, I'm just getting to the point now where it's like trying to determine whether I should be investing more money into my retirement, or we should be looking more at trying to put as much down into like a 529 or a college plan as possible. Because, well, to be quite honest, you know, before we'd gotten together, she was living, you know, sort of at the traditional 30-something lifestyle, right, whereas kind of bills as they accumulate and not putting a lot aside. And as we got together, that has changed. There's some other changes coming. It looks like she may end up losing her job. But that's not going to affect our lifestyle at all. As a matter of fact, our incomes really have been the combined incomes really have just lent us to have more, you know, play money, I guess.
So what do you have set aside at this point?
So right now I've got liquid assets in an emergency fund right around $20,000. I've got about $100,000 in my 401k, and I just started a Roth 401 as well.
Okay. And do you know if there is a college savings account somewhere?
There is not, as far as we've discussed. She doesn't have any, and her parents never had set up any for their grandkids.
Okay. Well, Kathy, he's in a pretty good situation as an individual. My real question is, since the kids are already 13 and 16, they don't have very long to save for school.
Right.
So what do you do if you haven't done anything up to that point?
Well, you know what? The biggest thing I would do is fund your retirement plans first.
Yeah.
Because essentially what's going to happen, you could put money in a 529 plan, but really the only tax benefit of a 529 plan is the investment income accumulated in that account is not taxable.
Okay.
Well,
You want that over time.
Right. Well, yeah, over a couple of years, the investment income is not likely to be so significant that that's going to be a big deal to you one way or the other. On the other hand, when you're filling out those financial aid forms, retirement assets do not count at all. And you're going to qualify for more aid. But the biggest factor that's going to affect how much aid you get is how much you earn. So you might need to fund a little bit less than you think. But I also think, how old are you, Tim?
37.
So, you know, really having about $200,000 put away is not a whole heck of a lot at 37.
Yeah.
So I would want to fund those retirement accounts as aggressively as I could. And I think I would start preparing the kids that the first couple of years that they're in school, they should be thinking about junior college. That will mean that your tuition and fees are negligible. If by some chance they get great scholarships, then, you know, they don't necessarily have to do junior college. But I think that that's really what you should be thinking about. And worry about college and as a secondary measure. I mean, college, there are student loans for college. There are no student loans for retirement.
Okay.
Does that help you out?
Yeah, very much so. Thank you very much.
All right, terrific. Thanks so much for the call, Tim.
Bye.
Thank you.
All right, next we have Jessica in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi there.
Hi.
What do you do there in Raleigh?
I'm a mom. I have three kids, so I mostly take care of them.
Aha, so you can relate to Tim's conversation, huh?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Are you thinking about the college funds yet?
I'm thinking about it. We've got other issues first, though.
Well, let's get to those. How can we help you out today?
Okay, well, so this is my question. My husband is in graduate school. He's been a nurse for a couple of years, and he just went back to school to become a nurse anesthetist.
Oh, okay.
We are 10 months from graduation, and we are running out of money. I have a small part-time job, but mostly I stay home and take care of the kids.
And does he have any income coming in while he's studying?
No.
No.
It's not a program where you're able to work.
Okay.
So we had some savings, a stipend from the local hospital where he'll work when he's done, and then I have a small part-time job.
Okay. And you say you had some savings?
We had. It's gone.
It's gone. Okay. So you have no savings at all, and you've got student loans coming up, and it sounds like what you're saying is your monthly budget is getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Right.
Okay. Well, so what's your plan for that at this point?
Okay. Well, option number one would be to get a private loan that I've already checked into. It's 10%. And then my other option was to use some money from our retirement account.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, none of those options are really good.
Right.
And so this is what I would think about. First of all, do you know where all of your money is being spent? And are you being as frugal right now as you should be?
Probably not. I didn't want them to feel like they were eating beans and rice for 2 years while Dad was, you know, going to school. I was trying to keep some level of, you know, normality for them.
But why? I mean, we're a family, right? And you have a goal, and the goal is to better your lot in life. And for your kids to know that that sometimes requires a sacrifice is not such a terrible thing. Your first place to start is to cut back. Taking money out of a retirement plan is particularly dangerous because it subjects you to extremely high tax rates and penalties. A private loan at 10%, I mean, if that's a fixed rate, still pretty dang high.
Yeah, that's a high interest rate.
Yeah. You're really going to be putting yourself in a hole if you start robbing yourself to pay for living expenses,
right,
particularly if those living expenses could be cut back. So I'm going to just say go to a consumer credit counseling service and work out a budget. Figure out where you can cut back. I mean, maybe you can do this on your own, but it's probably helpful to have somebody who will sit down with you and work through all the numbers and do a really realistic budget and slash your expenses as much as you possibly can. You've got 11 months. That's not a big deal. Your kids will not end up in counseling because they had to be a little bit more frugal for 11 months of their lives. But for you, it could be pivotal.
Yeah. You're right. Not the answer I want to hear, though.
But you know what, Jessica? I think you wouldn't have called us if you didn't want to hear a little of that tough love, because you could have.
I know.
I think you knew that borrowing is never the best answer that there is out there.
I know.
Let us know what you end up doing. Okay?
All right. Thanks for your time very much.
Good luck. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or go to our website and look for the Getting Personal page. That is at marketplace.org. Kathy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my because of your giant wallet. Just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Lee Transu. I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I work in book publishing. It is a very unimportant looking leather wallet. First is my Bank of America debit card, and then my driver's license. I have a Borders reward tab and a Duane Reade rewards tab, neither of which I use ever. You've shown me a revelation. I really need to go through my wallet and get rid of things I don't use. Oh, this is interesting. I totally forgot about this. I traveled to New Orleans and bought something called a Lucky Bean. It comes with a little piece of paper. The Lucky Mojo Wish Bean. The special bean has been blessed by local New Orleans voodoo practitioners for good luck. Hold the Lucky Mojo Wish Bean in your left hand and visualize the result you desire. Well, I don't think that I've actually massaged this bean in particular for good luck. Oh, there, I've lost it. Can't have gone far. It's got rolling power. I'll look for it. I guess it's not good luck after all, yeah.
All right, so one piece of advice we offer regularly to our callers is to make regular deposits into their retirement accounts. It's called dollar cost averaging. And what it does is ensure that you are buying steadily into the markets, whether they are up or down. But what if you got a better return by putting big chunks in all at once? Greg Fisher has some new research that says that indeed is the case. He's president and chief investment officer of Gerstein Fisher in New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here today.
I have to tell you, this is completely contrary to pretty much everything we say on this show. So give us the top reason why dollar cost averaging may not be the best strategy.
You know, the concept of dollar cost averaging for young accumulators that are systematically saving money for their futures, this is a good approach. And there's nothing wrong with that. But our research paper is really on the heels of the last decade of difficult market performance with lots of volatility. A lot of investors that are sitting on lump sums of cash are hesitant to put those funds to work because of the experience that they've had in the last 10 years in the market.
Right.
And here we're really talking more about, does an investor with a lump sum decide to invest in the markets all at once, or does that investor gradually move in over time, for example, over the next 12 months?
Well, then let's talk about what you actually found in this study in terms of the benefits of dollar cost averaging versus these lump sum inputs into the market. Give us the rundown of the numbers.
So basically what we did is we looked back to 1926 and we looked at the S&P 500 as a proxy for investing in equities.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was we looked at the idea of investing a sum of money at the beginning of the month and then holding for 20 years. We also looked at investing that same amount of money over 1 year.
Hmm.
What we found is that over rolling 20-year periods of time, historically, 70% of the time, I would have ended my 20-year period with more money doing the lump sum than dollar cost averaging in.
But if you are not dollar cost averaging, aren't you market timing? Because you can't know when you should be putting that lump sum into the market.
Well, that's true. If you're dollar cost averaging, you are making a decision to do it over 12 months, 18 months, 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
The problem I find with dollar cost averaging is imagine you're a dollar cost averager. So as I mentioned earlier, 70% of the time, the lump sum does better.
Mm-hmm.
But 30% of the time, dollar cost averaging did better. The reason it does better in those periods is because those are periods where the market's going down. So imagine you're putting in your money every month, and every month you put it in, it goes down. In my experience working with individual investors, when the market's going down, a lot of dollar cost averagers stop.
Right.
They actually say things like, look, the market's going down, let me slow it down or stop, and when the market starts going up again, then I'll start investing again.
Which is exactly what we tell them not to do, because then you're buying high and selling low.
That's correct.
Yeah. What should we take away from this? You know, particularly for those who are nearing the age of retirement, or are at retirement. They've taken their money out of the market. They are sitting on that lump sum that you're talking about. And they don't have the time, perhaps, to make up for it by dollar cost averaging, you know, over 20 years. Would those be real candidates then for just putting a lump sum in?
I think first, it really, of course, comes down to your overall strategy. But I think a key element here is if I'm an investor at age 60 thinking of retiring, I'm going to try to figure out how much money I'm going to need for the next 10 years, getting me to roughly 70 in this example. And that money I would consider having in short-term fixed income, cash, conservative investments to get me through a decade, so that the money I do put in the stock market, whether I move it in over 12 months or put it in as a lump sum, is truly assets and money that I'm not going to need for at least 10 years and preferably longer.
All right. Greg Fisher is President and Chief Investment Officer of Gerstein Fisher in New York, and we've been talking about their study about dollar cost averaging. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Every list has to have someone at the bottom. And when it comes to the average credit score for U.S. cities, three of the bottom five are in Texas. There's El Paso and Corpus Christi, and at the very bottom, the border town of Harlingen. Experian's second annual national survey found the average credit score there is 684. In a moment, we'll tell you about the city with the nation's best score. But first, Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies finds Harlingen is full of tough lessons in what not to do with your credit.
At the Harlingen Auto Credit used car lot, there's a row of faded red, white, and blue banners flapping in the breeze. They read come-ons to potential customers. We finance, easy terms, and buy here, pay here. Right now, there aren't any car shoppers, so salesman Al Gavan is inside manning the phones.
Harlingen Auto Credit, how may I help you?
Gavan wasn't surprised to learn that Harlingen has the worst average credit score in the nation. After all, he makes his living selling cars to people with terrible credit.
Your income pretty much dictates what you drive.
Income in the Rio Grande Valley is low. The per capita income is less than $14,000 a year. A quarter of that population is under the poverty line. Gavan doesn't even check credit scores. He knows his customers are risky, so he has a secret weapon. It's a GPS kill switch that can remotely shut a car down cold.
Whenever they just disappear and don't make payments, it's shut off, and they come in here and make their payment, and they're back on the road.
Credit counselor Olga Gonzalez tells her troubled clients to avoid places like Harlingen Auto Credit. Lucina Soto came to the Harlingen Community Development Corporation looking to qualify to buy a government-backed house. Gonzalez told her, steer clear of debt and build up that credit score.
Lucina came to us 2 years ago and we denied her. Lack of credit, no credit, and she wasn't fully employed then. So she was told what she needed to do and now she's back trying again.
Lucina is a U.S. citizen, but speaks only a little English. But she knows the important words when it comes to credit cards.
Swipe it. Just swipe it.
At first, Lucina had no credit score. She worked at the flea market and lived in the cash-only economy. Gonzalez told her to build her credit by taking out some easy loans from a corner local lender. Mission accomplished, but then came the credit card offers, and Lucina started swiping. Her credit score crashed. It's now 653. Gonzalez warns her clients not to rack up more than 30% of their credit limit.
So if they give you $1,000, your credit card should only be at 350 because going over 50% brings your credit scores down.
Fabiola Nunez is another client for Gonzalez, and at first she tried to rebuild her credit by going to a neighborhood so-called credit repair agency.
Porque ellos hacen un trato contigo.
Fabiola said the credit repair was a scam. They took her money and they didn't pay her bills. They left her poorer and torpedoed her credit score. Gonzalez said this is a common story in Harlingen and she cautions her clients.
Do not go pay the $500 when you can do it yourself. Attend these classes and let's put you on a payment plan. You can call the lender. They will work with you. They set up a plan.
Fabiola's credit score also took a beating when she did something that many in Harlingen do without a second thought. She lent her Social Security number to a friend. It was basically self-inflicted identity theft.
They're giving someone a couple $100 and use the Social Security card so that they can work here. Well, at the end, these people are using it to purchase stuff. And then here, 3-4 years later, you find out that they had opened up so much credit, you have no scores now.
Many of these problems can be traced back to the lack of financial literacy. Bertha Garza is a vice president with the International Bank of Commerce. It's a regional bank with deep roots on the border. Garza says the big problem is a large part of the local population is unbanked.
People that do not know and cannot trust the banking system because they don't understand it. They've never deposited money in a bank, and they don't know how it works.
She started a program called Money Smart to teach financial literacy in local schools, starting in the fifth grade.
Little by little, we are changing the community. It's going to take years.
Garza said if people in the valley are going to find some upward economic mobility, they need to understand how money and credit works for you and against you. In Harlingen, Texas, I'm David Martin Davies for Marketplace Money.
All right, from worst to first. For the best credit scores in the nation, we head north from Texas to, drumroll please, Wisconsin. Don't dislocate your shoulders patting yourselves on the back. At the very top of the list is Wausau, a small city in the middle of the Badger State with an average credit score of 789. We asked Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio to figure out why.
The people of Wausau might be so creditworthy because they're tight-fisted. Like many communities in the upper Midwest, they've learned to save thanks to their shared history. In the late 1800s, the region was ruled by lumber barons who floated giant pine logs down the Wisconsin River. When the ancient forests were clear-cut, towns like Wausau suffered, but this city managed to build new companies, Wausau Insurance and Wausau Paper. Developer Mark Craig says the foresight of those early leaders helped create a thriving downtown.
We have a diverse economy and great transportation routes and great leaders that have got us to a spot today where we can boast about a community that is continually growing in spite of some very tough economic times.
Despite the growth, Wausau still has a small town feel. It's late morning at the Mint Cafe, which has been serving food at its downtown location since 1888. At one of the tables, high school coach Derek Steinke treats seven members of his girls' swim team to breakfast.
It's a good family environment. It's a good place to raise your family. We have a low crime rate. We take pride in our city. We're honest people. We like to pay back what we borrow.
The pay-as-you-go attitude has led to high credit scores, according to Todd Nagel, the president of Wausau's family-owned River Valley Bank.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing higher credit scores here in the Wausau area, and I just think it's that people are more conservative with their money. There's not a lot of flashy things to do around here.
Nagel says when people here borrow money to buy a home, they usually already have the 20% down payment, and housing prices are a bargain. You can get a decent starter home in a good neighborhood for less than $50,000.
We just hired a new chief financial officer here at the bank. He moved here from Madison. He's so excited because he can buy a place, a house on the lake, for the same price that he could buy his house in the neighborhood in Madison.
Lake Wausau and the Wisconsin River were once vital for the lumber industry. Now they're centers for recreation and tourism. But the region is not free from challenges. Wausau Insurance no longer exists, and Wausau Paper may sell the mill where the company got its start. A native son who represented the area for 41 years in Congress, Dave Obey, says his city also struggled with racial integration.
Just 30 years ago, it was the most lily-white community in the country. Virtually no racial minorities whatsoever. Then the Hmong came in. It caused a huge uproar for years.
When the Hmong arrived, they couldn't write or speak English. Now the Southeast Asian refugees own stores, work in offices and factories, and have helped make Wausau the country's leading producer of ginseng. Obey says the Hmong's old world attitudes about work and money fit right in.
Today you have many, many solid citizens in that community, and the community has learned to deal with the fact that it isn't lily white anymore, and the sky hasn't fallen. You have a tremendous work ethic.
A diverse economy, affordable housing, hard work, and penny pinching. These are the things the people of Wausau credit for those high credit scores. In Wausau, Wisconsin, I'm Glenn Moberg for Marketplace Money.
And we've got the full list of Experian's top 10 best and worst cities for credit scores at marketplace.org. Now we return to the question of job creation. It is the number one economic issue in this country, yet no one seems to have figured out how to get companies to hire more people. Howard Schultz has brewed up an idea that he hopes could make a grande dent in the problem. The Starbucks founder and CEO launched an effort called Create Jobs for USA. It's a micro-lending program aimed at helping small businesses hire more employees. The money will come, in part, from Starbucks customers, who this week started to see $5 donation cards next to the cash register. Howard Schultz, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you brought gourmet coffee to the masses. Now you want to be a banker. Square that circle for me.
Well, I don't want to be a banker. What I'm trying to do more than anything else is use Starbucks scale for good. When I look at the landscape of 9.1% unemployment, almost double that in the Hispanic and African-American community, I believe that we can, at Starbucks, leverage the equity of our brand in a way that's quite unique. We will collect millions of dollars, and we will get it in the hands of the Opportunity Finance Network, which has a national organization of community-based loan organizations that will provide access to credit to small businesses, startup businesses that will be a catalyst for job creation at a time in America when, unfortunately, banks are not lending.
Explain for us how that dollar donated by one of your customers will end up helping create a job at a small business.
Well, I think there is evidence among small businesses that they're having problems getting access to credit that they've gotten before. And so when we examine what we could do, we uncovered the Opportunity Finance Network, which among their network is these organizations that are community-based, many in underserved communities across the country. We will provide millions of dollars to these organizations, and they will vet the companies that are trying to get access to credit, provide them with a low-interest loan, anywhere from $10,000 to $500,000, and 100% of all the donations will go to the cause. Starbucks will provide $5 million as a starter from our own foundation, and we'll absorb the cost of anything to do on the administration level.
So this is not a grant. It's an actual loan. So when the business pays back that loan, where does that money go? It goes back into the fund?
Exactly. And, Starbucks has been involved in microloans and microfinancing in emerging countries, and what we found is that 98% of those loans are paid back. And in fact, the Opportunity Finance Network has given us their own statistics, almost the exact same scenario, 97-98% of those loans that they've been lending has actually been paid back.
According to the information that you've released, for every $3,000 donated through the program, a job will be created or maintained. Can you help us understand the math there? Because $3,000 doesn't sound like a lot to keep someone in a job.
Yes. For every dollar that we raise, the Opportunity Finance Network, or the OFN, is able to raise more equity and borrow against it. So there's a multiplier of 7 times. We also learned that the number that equates to a job is $20,000. So the $3,000 that you quoted times 7 gives us the job that will be created and is sustainable.
What's your ultimate hope for this effort? Microlending has a bit of a mixed track record.
True.
Certainly a lot of success, but also some questions raised about it. What are you hoping to see at the very end?
Well, first off, we're setting up within Starbucks a small group of people that will be engaged in this process from the very beginning to ensure the fact that the concerns that you raised do not come to fruition. But in addition to that, we hope that we can create a message and a signal to other businesses and other corporations that we can't wait for Washington. We need to do our part. And also, I think after the first of the year, we'll be announcing partnerships whose companies have assets and complementary skills that will bring more reach, more awareness, and more money to this cause.
How confident are you that your public, your customers are going to step up to the plate here? I mean, there isn't a great track record for efforts like this where you kind of put out a jar, basically, and say, can you help out your fellow man?
I have optimism that this is a different moment in time where Americans are going to help Americans. There's millions of people who come through Starbucks every day, and I believe we've created the kind of proposition that they will trust and support.
And in closing, any chance I could convince you to make the pumpkin spice latte a year-round treat? Please?
Oh, that's funny. I'll consider that.
Howard Schultz, thank you.
Thank you.
And to that question of whether folks will actually donate, we stopped by a Starbucks here in L.A. and asked a few customers.
It was pretty inexpensive given what you pay for a coffee, so I'm not sure how effective it'll be, but I'm hoping that it will be effective.
And I would want to know more about how the program worked.
It's not a significant amount of money for most people, and it's for a good cause.
I think anything we can do to stimulate the economy is a good idea. If they asked me, I might consider it.
Finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend would like to meet his new owner in St. Louis, Louis, but not at the fair. Instead, in her classroom. Laura Crowley teaches 7th through 12th graders at the John Burroughs School in the St. Louis suburb of Ladue. This month, she wrote an article in Mathematics Teacher Magazine titled My Favorite Lesson. In the piece, she describes a project for high school juniors and seniors that requires them to figure out the true dollar cost of attending a college of their choice. After that, they got to come up with a plan to pay for it. Then they present the plan to their parents and to the class. The result? Well, she writes that students love the project, and parents love that it gets their kids thinking about money and the value of college. So, congratulations, Ms. Crowley. Perhaps our porcine friend can help the kids with their pigonometry. Oh boy. We'll have a link to her article on our website. And if you are marveling at the fact that we read Mathematics Teacher Magazine, yeah, we don't. But listener and math tutor Jane Gillette of Wakefield, Massachusetts does, and she nominated Ms. Crowley for the Piggy Award. Now, who do you want to nominate? Boink, boink. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, we partner with the New York Times for a special report titled Which Way Home? It's been 3 years since the housing bubble popped. We ask what role the home plays today in the American dream.
She'd send the paperwork in and then they say, well, we don't have all of it. So we had to keep doing it. That was frustrating.
Little did we know that within 24 months after we bought this place, this whole artificial bubble would explode.
To me, I guess it's kind of a safe place to be. It's a place where you can nurture your children and they can always come home to.
My thinking about home ownership's totally changed in terms of its role in a financial plan. It's not an investment. It's a place you live.
Find our coverage in the New York Times on Wednesday and right back here next weekend. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.